1 quart cream, 1 quart milk, 1 dozen tablespoons sugar, 1 pint brandy, 1 half pint rye whiskey, 1 half pint Jamaica rum, 1 fourth pint sherry. Mix liquor first, then separate yolks and whites of eggs, add sugar to beaten yolks, mix well, add milk and cream, slowly beating, beat whites of eggs until stiff and fold slowly into mixture. Let set in cool place for several days. Taste frequently. That is a recipe for eggnog by none other than George Washington.
I only assumed that it was a James Bond villain's eggnog recipe from The Voice.
Yeah, funny story. All James Bond villains are based on George Washington.
Okay.
Accent-wise. Uh-huh. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Ben.
That's that famous Mount Vernon accent I've heard so much about, right? I'm Noel. And, yeah. And this is Ridiculous History. And we started off with like a really functional little nugget there. That was nice.
Yeah, that's a recipe that is genuinely believed to be George Washington's eggnog recipe, but there's one very important missing part of this recipe. Did you catch it?
No.
He doesn't say how many eggs should be in there.
Oh.
And you'll see a lot of versions of this recipe wherein someone has assumed, like based on the ratio of other ingredients,
okay,
that it would be about a dozen eggs, but he didn't actually say that.
What's the batch? What's the yield on this recipe?
Well, I guess that's up to how much you like eggnog, man.
I guess so. Doesn't a recipe typically
include number of servings?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a very different time.
This wasn't from Tasty.
Right. This wasn't Taste Made.
Epicurious.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Or Good Eats or anything.
Yeah. What's funny, you should mention Washington's nog, because our coworker and pal Alex Williams, who composed our theme around the holidays, he made a big old batch of Washington's nog, mm-hmm, and distributed it around the office in these delightful little mason jars. I was lucky enough to get my hands on one, and it packed quite a wallop. Because
mm-hmm,
a big thing leading up to doing this episode is, how could you possibly get off your tits drunk on eggnog?
Right, because nowadays we typically associate eggnog as this very seasonally based, cozy drink. Like, you sip it by a fire.
It's a comfort drink.
It's a comfort drink.
It's like
there
a hug in drink form.
Yeah, yeah. It's a slightly boozy attaboy for you, mm-hmm, around the holidays. Mm-hmm. But as you could tell from the recipe we started the show with, eggnog back in the day used to pack quite a punch. This was after it evolved from a much older drink known as posset.
Yeah, which was also known as a milk punch, which sounds disgusting.
So bad. There's something in, and please, listeners, friends, and neighbors, say hello to our super producer, Casey Pegram. There's something that I heard of before that I've never tried, but I want to learn about. It was called milk salad. Does that not sound disgusting?
Really bad. It makes me think of our Jell-O episode.
Right. We got some great emails about that today. And this beginning, folks, may make you think that my co-host and I are delving into the history of eggnog, and we do just a little bit. But it's to set the scene for a ridiculous event, and we thought this would be the yummiest, weirdest place to start.
Yeah, well, first I just want to describe what posset is. We talked about milk punch and the precursor, or the spiritual cousin that predates eggnog, called posset, that was a hot milk punch using curdled milk, and it was curdled with wine or beer. Or I guess you get curdles when you heat it. And then eventually it was thickened with eggs and kind of became more what we know today as traditional eggnog. But our story is really about a riot involving drunken cadets.
I'm going to go with quote-unquote riot on this one, Noel.
Really?
Okay, at what threshold does a fracas or a brouhaha become a full-on riot?
That's true. I was going to open the show with a joke about how many 1800s West Point cadets does it take to assault two officers and break all of the china.
And we know the answer.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. So let's talk a little bit about West Point in general. West Point remains famous today. It is a storied institution here in the United States. It is named West Point because, in a stunning plot twist, it is located in West Point, New York.
Yeah, it's about 50 miles outside of New York City, and storied it was. However, it didn't used to be the model of discipline and steadfastness, fastidiousness that it is today.
Right.
Because in the early days of the school, it was ridiculously easy to get in that they let anyone in. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you could join any time during the year. And it was just kind of a loose grouping of ramshackled little huts. And I think it was about 10 cadets that were taught by, I think, only three teachers. You know, but then a little thing called the War of 1812 happened, which was, you know, against Britain because the Brits were attempting to restrict trade and they kept arresting American seamen, which is not cool, as we know, and also inciting Indian attacks on the U.S. frontier. So that aggression would not stand, my friend. So we decided to go to war with the Brits, and that also led to a need for disciplined soldiers.
Right. Disciplined, professional, competent soldiers. And there's a character here in the evolution of West Point that we must absolutely mention, if only because he has an awesome name.
Yeah, it's like a Dumbledorean awesome name.
Sylvanus Thayer, ladies and gentlemen, in 1817, then-President James Monroe ordered Thayer to become the superintendent of the military academy after the resignation of the former superintendent, Alden Partridge, and
Also a pretty cool name.
Also a cool name.
By his own right.
Yeah, by his own right. Not Harry Potter-esque, but cool nonetheless. That accidentally rhymed. Under Thayer's leadership, the academy began to make incredibly impressive leaps and bounds in terms of discipline, in terms of quality of education. It became the nation's first college of engineering.
Well, Thayer didn't take no guff, my friend. He didn't put up with any horseplay, shenanigans, or buffoonery, especially when it pertained to consuming or even possessing alcohol of any kind.
Right. Alcohol could not be possessed, sold, or brought into West Point at all. And this was just another part of his overall very strict regime. For instance, he kept the students on a diet of beef, bread, and water to accustom them to military rations. Their days were strictly controlled as far as the way their time was organized. And they had a lot of pressure on them. So imagine these students like springs that are increasingly compressed, storing up more energy and tension.
Yeah, they weren't even allowed. Some of these rules are, I don't understand. They weren't allowed to leave campus. I guess I can get that, because if you leave campus, you can get booze. I guess that's nipping that in the bud. Also, they couldn't cook in their dorms or duel.
Right, right.
Those seem related. I made a note in the margins here in this this article from the Smithsonian Eggnog. It's all fun and games until someone starts a holiday riot. It said, before Thayer, West Point sucked or was awesome. Whatever.
Yeah, that's by Natasha Gehling. And yeah, this article is very well written. And I noticed some of the same rules you're talking about here. And to me, the dueling one makes a lot of sense, because you imagine, you know, they're in a homogenous population, right? This was strictly segregated, but for the time, it started to become relatively progressive because it was important for kids from a lower income level, right, or a lower socioeconomic bracket, to receive the same caliber of education if they were qualified for it. But with all the discipline in the harsh environment, I can easily imagine that if duels were allowed, these kids would be punching each other up and pulling cards left and right.
Yeah, yeah. Fisticuffs and gun battles galore. It's interesting because even though alcohol was forbidden at West Point, it was surrounded by normal things that you have in towns, like pubs. And there were a couple. There was one called Benny Haven and then another one called North's Tavern. And those will come into play in a little bit. But Benny Haven is also known for being the main hangout for Edgar Allan Poe when he attended West Point. Admittedly, not for a very long time because he right. You know, mainly just hung out and got sloshed the whole time.
That's the story.
But there was a history of getting sloshed at West Point before our pal Thayer came in. In the days before his iron-fisted grip tightened around these cadets and tried to whip those boys into shape, they had a yearly kind of revelry kind of thing going on around the holidays, didn't they?
Right. This is important. It may seem strange today, but in the past, in those days, heavy drinking was, or drinking in general, was more common. It was something that was normal for people to do. You'll also hear some stories about early founding fathers and influential historical figures being several mattress factory amounts of sheets to the wind. And we're establishing this because when Thayer came in, he wasn't creating out of whole cloth this strict set of rules. He was reacting to what he saw as laxity in the past, and people, students, officers alike, were well aware of the previous traditions.
Oh, and you mentioned historical figures and founding fathers. One, a couple that are part of the story are our boy Jeff Davis, Jefferson for long, and Robert E. Lee were both involved in this tale of debauchery and chastisement.
Yes. Okay, so here's how it happens. Up until 1825, cadets, alcohol was still banned, but there were 2 days a year that they could drink. That was the 4th of July.
Yep.
Makes sense.
Yep.
Go US, right?
Live it up.
And then, of course, Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And then this changed because on the 4th of July in 1825, a bunch of cadets drinking led to a snake dance, which led to the hoisting of the school's commandant onto the students' shoulders. And Thayer said, you know what? This is too much.
A snake dance?
Snake dance.
Like, is that some kind of...
Is it a conga line?
Yeah.
Or is it a bunch of people just sort of slithering up and down?
He didn't like it because it just wasn't dignified?
You know, it makes me think of, remember when we did the episode about the Poison Squad?
Mm-hmm.
When Wiley got booted from his professorship for riding a bike?
Oh.
So maybe it was just the idea that this was such a lack of discipline for them to put someone on their shoulders.
Yeah.
That he said, no alcohol ever.
Well, yeah, I did say he was not fond of horsing around. That sounds like the very definition of horsing around, snaking around.
There we go.
So, Ben, just want to get this straight. So
yeah.
He still allowed this revelry at first and then shut it down after one of these went awry by his standards?
Yeah, 1826 onward, no alcohol, not once, never.
Not a drop. Was he a teetotaler, do you think, or do you think he would get in his cups privately? He seems like a pretty straight shooter.
He seems like a straight shooter, but, you know, you have to wonder if he applied those same rules to himself.
Do as I say, not as I get hammered.
Right. Drink as I say, not as I drink. And, you know, I love that you mention these taverns because they didn't magically disappear.
Oh, no.
After 1826. And Benny Haven is the really interesting one there because of those two taverns we mentioned earlier, Benny Haven was the only one that allowed a barter system for the students.
Oh, I know. This is really interesting. So they could, like, trade shoes and pantaloons and, you know, maybe potatoes. Who knows? Anything, I guess, was on the table, except if it came from the school.
Right. No uniforms.
No, because that would be... That would be stealing, and they do not want to get on the bad side of Colonel Thayer. No, sir, they do not.
Right. And
sounds like a tough customer, that Colonel Thayer.
Yeah, people took him seriously. But you also have to wonder, would you barter stuff for booze?
Yes.
You would?
If I didn't have any pocket money.
If you didn't have 35 cents on hand, which will come into play later.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't barter away the clothes on my back. But if I had something of value that I could part with and I wanted a nice stiff drink, I'm not opposed to that.
So when does...
Are you judging me? Are you silently judging me, Ben?
No. Okay. I'm judging myself.
Okay, fair enough. Me too. Nah, Ben, you're great.
You know what? Together, we're a solid 8 out of 10. And, you know, we can never compare to Casey Pegram, which is not a bad thing.
Well, none can. Few can.
Few, very few.
Between the two of us, we practically make a whole person.
We're getting there for sure. So, Noel, this situation is unsustainable to the students, right? To the cadets?
The aforementioned winding spring ready to pop.
So this all comes to a head when Christmas Eve of 1826 rolls around. Again, that's one of the 2 days the cadets are allowed to drink, to imbibe, and this is the first time they can't.
And, you know, no one likes it when you tell them they can't do something.
Sure.
Don't tell me what I can't do, Ben.
Yeah, don't tell me what I can't do. I will automatically go do it.
Yeah.
Reverse psychology is real, it's dangerous, and people know it works.
Yeah, but clearly, Thayer, that was not his style. He was much more of a prohibitor than a mind manipulator.
A mind wrangler.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, these cadets on Christmas Eve of 1826, about 70 of them, as it turns out, which I think was somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of the student body of West Point, decided to hatch a little plot where they were going to go against old Colonel Thayer's wishes and get themselves some boozy eggnog.
Right. So they decided that they would go off campus and go to the place they knew that was going to be the friendliest tavern, which was, of course, Benny Haven.
Benny Haven. Maybe they brought some extra pairs of socks with which to barter.
However, Benny Haven proved, without us remarking on the socks or the pantaloons or whatever they brought with them.
Doesn't matter.
Right. Benny Haven's was too expensive.
Too steep.
Yeah. They could buy a little bit of liquor, but not as much as they wanted. So they had to go to Plan B.
They wanted to get ripping drunk.
Oh, we should call it Plan H.
I like it. Because why?
Because they crossed the Hudson River.
Oh, exactly. That's very, very good foreshadowing there, Ben. So yes, they did in fact cross the Hudson River. I imagine on some sort of sloop. Perhaps a barge, some sort of, maybe surely they had vessels at their disposal, right? It's a military academy. What do you think? What do you picture them crossing on?
One would imagine they wouldn't swim because of the weather.
Yeah, it'd be cold.
So they were probably on, you know, a small boat or something. Oh, yeah. Maybe they just rowed across.
I like it. I like it. I'm just trying to set the scene is all, you know? Mm-hmm. So this is under the cover of night. No doubt. Mm-hmm. They go over to the pub we mentioned briefly earlier, the tavern, I guess, North's Tavern, where they made a deal with the bartender, the barkeep, and they procured in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 gallons of whiskey.
Yeah. They
ought to do it.
Yeah, they got gallons of whiskey. And while they were there, they had... the historical quote we found is a few glasses themselves.
Ah.
Now, this, I think, leads into the—
One for the chef.
Right. Leads to the domino effect we'll see later, because the size of those glasses as we record this, that size is lost to history. So we have no idea how large these glasses were. But anyway, the cadets knocked back a few. They went back to the dock, and they found a soldier who was standing guard. But they said, you know what, man, turn a blind eye, which wasn't unusual, right? Mm. And he said, what price do you expect me to put on my morals? This conversation is inspired by a true story, I should say. And they named a price.
And he accepted.
And what was that price?
It was 35 cents.
It was 35 cents.
Do you want to plug that into your handy-dandy inflation calculator, Ben?
You're going to find this hilarious. And listeners, I hope you enjoy this too. In 1826, 35 cents was the equivalent of— Casey, can we get a drum roll, please? $8.09.
Okay, so cheap morals.
$8.09.
Wow.
I mean, that's bizarre. I can't imagine
a bribe that would work at that price level.
Yeah. No, I can't either. I would have at least asked for some of that whiskey.
Right?
Maybe surely. He did. Surely they plied him with booze. Let's editorialize here. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. No one's going to take 850 without a couple of shots first, right?
Yes. Yeah. So we go back to Colonel Thayer, and sure, he was a bit draconian, but that doesn't make him a dunderhead. It doesn't make him stupid.
No. He was clearly a pretty savvy fellow.
Mm-hmm. And he knew that cadets had smuggled alcohol into the academy before. In fact, one of our characters in here has a history that we'll get to in a bit. But he had always, and the staff and officer structure of West Point had always dealt with these on a case-by-case basis. So he assumed, reasonably so, that there would be at least one bad, or should we say one drunk apple, mm-hmm. ooh, one fermented apple
like
in the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
So he had talked about it with some of the staff and the fellow officers, but he just took the regular precautions.
Was it like two guards?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Captain Ethan Allen Hitchcock and Lieutenant William A. Thornton, they were to monitor the North Barracks.
Old Hitchcock and Thornton. They have, they're about to have some fun.
Yes. Yeah. They go to bed. They knock off around midnight, right?
Yep, that's right. At which point, the boys who sallied forth for the North,
mm-hmm.
The tavern,
yeah,
are now back in their respective dorms. I guess they snuck into the kitchen and made the nog. Speaking of which, what part of the egg is the nog, Ben? That's the question I think everyone wants to know.
Well, that's a good question. Let's see. Is there an answer?
There is. I was being a little coy. So no one knows exactly, and it's certainly a bit of a turn of phrase. There is no nog to the egg. It's not a part of the egg. I think you all probably already knew that. But it turns out that the word nog was an old English slang for a very stiff beer.
Okay.
Yeah, and you've also heard, like, grog, right?
Sure.
And so yeah. I'm assuming that there's some relation there. And then another one is that the idea that these wooden mugs that you could find in taverns all across the land were called noggins.
Oh.
And so apparently, and this is from an article on a delightful blog called Sustainable Table about mm-hmm. the history of eggnog, and they conjecture that when you combine noggin with egg,
mm-hmm.
you get eggnog. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a little aside.
That's solid. Oh, but we should also add that the three cadets who went across the Hudson were not alone in their endeavor. This was a group effort. According to the Eggnog Riot on Laugham's Quarterly by Michelle Legro, they were joined with conspirators, colluders. You see, another group brought a gallon of brandy and a gallon of wine, and another one, get this phrase, Noel, organized a gallon of liquor on credit. And then someone else bought the eggs, the milk, and the nutmeg. So they had all the ingredients assembled together, and they got wasted. They got so wasted that 4 hours after midnight, the two officers we mentioned, Thornton and Hitchcock, woke up with a very, we're a family show, so let's call it a very OMG WTF reaction.
Yeah, it was a clamor, a hubbub.
There arose such a clamor, yes.
Yeah, indeed, but it was not jolly old St. Nick. No, it was a bunch of unruly, drunken military school cadets.
Which has just got to be the worst. They were, well, let me correct here. So after the officers went to bed, they started drinking, the mm-hmm. cadets. And then you'll hear either around 2 a.m. or 4 a.m., the feather of drunken noise broke the proverbial camel of silence's back.
We all know the sound. If you've lived next door to a frat house or anything, if you've ever,
sure.
you know, had any kind of unruly neighbors that are having a party when you're trying to sleep,
mm-hmm.
it's a very specific sound. Sounds totally different when you yourself are drunk. Sounds delightful.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds just like the sound of fun.
Sounds merry, you know.
But when you're trying to sleep.
Sure.
It's an instant enrager.
So they were making merry around 2 a.m., Jefferson Davis and eight other cadets started singing very loudly. Another student tried to do the 1826 version of, shh, you guys, come on.
Come on.
Shh, be cool. And by 4 a.m., the sound's blasting through the floorboards, and that triggers the investigation.
Did we talk about Jeff Davis? Jeffy?
We should talk about Jeff Davis, because we just mentioned him as leading the singing. He was... He was one of those kids with a past.
Absolutely. And a future. He went on to become the president of the...
U.S. Confederacy.
Yep, that's the one. But he was what you might describe as an incorrigible drunk.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a history of being censured for leaving his post to drink at the bar. In fact, he racked up an arrest.
He did. He got arrested. I think he was the first student to be arrested for sneaking away to go to Benny Haven. And not long before the eggnog riot that we're talking about, he was with some pals sneaking, and he fell into a pit. And his pals cried out, "Are you alive?" And thankfully, yeah, he was alive. Mm-hmm. But you don't know, man. A ravine?
Right.
Good Lord, he could have hit his head on a rock.
And that's 60 feet, so that's nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah.
So this guy, when they're organizing this secret Christmas party, Jefferson Davis is one of the top picks. He's like a veteran of this sort of thing.
Yeah, he was totally on board. And our heroes, for all intents and purposes, yeah, heroes or buzzkills. Depends on what side of this. I'm annoyed at the cadets, to be honest. That's where
sure.
I stand.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're being a little disrespectful.
I feel you, but it's Christmas Eve, man.
No, it's not. It's Christmas.
It's oh, yeah, a.m. Now it's officially Christmas. Okay, even more. It's Christmas Day.
Have a little charity. Where's my, yeah. Okay, so, but I'm just saying, like, I've been around drunk people when I'm sober and trying to sleep enough that I am feeling these two guards' perspective here pretty hard. So one of them, Hitchcock, leaps out of bed with a start and finds a handful of the boys, six or seven of them, visibly sloshed,
mm-hmm.
and he... He, I love the way this article puts it, the Smithsonian article. He ordered them to disperse.
Right.
And they refused. They refused to disperse.
And it sounds so formal at this point. You know, it sounds as though they had a decision-making process, but it had to be more sloppy and more emotionally charged. He thought it was just that one room at first, but it turns out it wasn't.
Oh, no, it wasn't. He then went into another room, and he was actually followed by our boy Jeff Davis, who tried to give his compatriots the heads up by shouting,
"Put away the grog, boys! Old Hitch is coming!"
Old Hitchcock. But of course he was already there.
He was literally there.
He was
there.
Like right behind him or right in front of him. So, you know, he looked like a chump. Mm-hmm. And then Hitchcock ordered Jeffy to disperse, and he agreed.
Yeah.
Which is probably the one thing that saved him from getting court-martialed and expelled. So, you know, we can thank Hitchcock and his kind-hearted nature for, you know, Jefferson Davis's future in politics.
Yeah, no one knew what was going to happen at the time.
Exactly.
So Davis is arrested. Others are arrested, ordered to their rooms. And this is weird because we asked at the top of the show what constitutes a riot.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Hitchcock read the group the Riot Act, which declared any group of 12 or more unlawfully assembled.
Wait, that's a real thing? The Riot Act?
That's how they have it here, yeah.
So when you say when you're reading someone the Riot Act, that's literally like you're telling them their rights?
Yeah, the original Riot Act, again, real thing, was passed back in 1714 in Britain, and it essentially ruled that if a group of a dozen or more people got together and started acting unruly, an officer of the law could approach them and tell them to disperse. But to do so, they literally had to read the Riot Act. So the cadets are really PO'd right now because they had this one party. In their minds, it's one of two nights they can let loose the entire year.
Yeah, because we can't forget that it's hard to come in and like just change things overnight. Like if they're used to having these parties and then you've got this killjoy Thayer coming in and denying them their two nights of revelry a year, mm-hmm. that stings a little. You know, this was very fresh for them. So
mm-hmm. here's where I start to lose sympathy for the cadets.
Yeah.
So after now they're angry at Hitchcock for ruining the soiree,
right,
the get together. They decide to hunt the captain down. They decide that vengeance is theirs. And we have a great quote for how that segment of the night began.
Yeah, Hitchcock took off. And then one of the drunken cadets screamed, "Get your dirks and bayonets and pistols if you have them. Before the night is over, Hitchcock will be dead." So that's, you know, that's a threat of bodily harm to a superior officer. That's probably not going to fly, right?
Right. So there's a book written by James B. Agnew called The Eggnog Riot, The Christmas Mutiny at West Point. Maybe mutiny is a little better word, but again, he did read the Riot Act. So.
True.
So this book gives a minute-by-minute treatment account or estimation about how things went down. And from that point, so let's say it's around 4 a.m., over the next 2 hours, there was a cat-and-mouse game between the drunk students, the faculty of West Point, and the sober students, you know, the nerds,
mm-hmm. yeah.
who woke up to side with the faculty against their fellow cadets.
Yeah, and the other guy, Thornton, the other guard, he had a sword brandished in his face. He got brained with a piece of wood, got knocked on his butt. And I think Hitchcock was trying to break into a door that had been, like, barricaded,
mm-hmm.
and someone took a shot at him from the other side of the door.
Yeah.
With a pistol. I mean, this is, I think Riot is absolutely fair.
Right. And just to go back a second to establish how drunk these cadets were, when Hitchcock originally busted them, several of them, Noel, tried to hide under blankets. Like, mm-hmm. while he's there, like, if I just hide under this blanket,
yeah.
no one will see me.
Right. I think some of them took their hats and covered their faces.
Uh-huh.
Like, you think that's going to work?
Right.
What's going on?
So this is where they start doing incredible physical damage, not just threatening the officers, but damaging the property as well, breaking windows, ripping banisters off of staircases.
Yeah, just like shredding the curtains, whatever they could get their hands on. I mean, it was a melee. And so Hitchcock and Thornton decided they'd better call in the cavalry. And it was these guys called the Bombardiers who were the guards that always kind of stood watch to make sure. It's sort of like internal affairs for cops, you know? It's like nobody likes internal affairs if you're a cop because they're like it's like a snitch.
Mm-hmm.
So the cadets did not care for the Bombardiers. And once they got called in, things just got even nastier.
Right, because the cadets hated these artillerymen, and they thought Hitchcock summoning them was this, quote, affront to their integrity. And if you read between the lines of history here, it sounds like they were just sloshed enough that they were going to get angry about anything.
Well, they were obviously having delusions of grandeur, too. It's like, who the hell do they think they are? You know?
They were trained in warfare.
Well, I'm just saying, like, they're students at this school.
Mm-hmm.
These are their commanding officers. There is two nights of partying a year or no, there is a military structure in place here, right?
Yeah.
Like, this just seems like a mass hysteria kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as things went further off the rails, it turned out that the Bombardiers or these artillerymen never actually showed up, and slowly, painfully, I would imagine, these cadets began to sober up.
Mm-hmm.
But not successfully, in enough time to be up at their scheduled hour, which was
6 a.m.
6 a.m.
Oof.
Oof. Yeah. Oof on a regular day.
They would, exactly. They were probably not feeling super well. And finally, a man who is the commandant of cadets. Sounds like a really intense name, sort of like the king of cartoons from Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah, there we go.
The commandant of cadets. He struck enough fear into the hearts of these boys that they chilled out. They stopped breaking stuff.
They were probably also getting tired.
Yeah.
So
and pukey.
Yeah. Jefferson Davis, according to the accounts, had missed the bulk of the night's events because instead of resisting arrest when he was put under his arrest, he stumbled to his room, threw up a little bit, and passed out.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually turned out well for him because he wasn't party to a lot of the more violent events. In his memoirs, he would later claim that he didn't name names or, you know, snitch on other people, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
But the records show he indicated that his roommate was involved in the conflict when the cadet returned to their dorm, waking Davis up as he loaded his gun. So his roommate was the one who fired the shot.
Yeesh. Not a good look. So Thayer was, you know, rightfully pretty upset.
Oh, yeah.
And he gathered all of his staff for an inquiry on the next night. And then over the following weeks, they placed 22 cadets on restriction, and then they started to develop an investigation, a court of inquiry, and that was issued by Major General Alexander McComb, who is the chief engineer of the Army and inspector of the Academy. And this is actually from an article on the U.S. Army's website regarding the eggnog riot, and they have access to. There's apparently a whole lot of ink that was spilled over this thing in terms of internal records. This is a big deal, right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
This is a huge deal.
This is a premier institution. And we have the names of the cadets that we can list off. I'm going to do it very quickly.
Yep.
The cadets were Ainsquith, Berrien, Bomford, Burnley, Farrelly, Fitzgerald, Guard, Guyon, Humphreys, Johnson, Lewis, Mercer, Murdoch, Norvell, Roberts, Scriven, Stocker, Swords, and Thompson. They all stood trial. And other cadets, including Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee, testified for the defense. 11 of that group were dismissed, and the remainder were allowed to stay, although three of them, Guard, Murdoch, and Norvell, chose to leave the academy anyway. You can't fire me.
I quit.
Indeed.
And, you know, and you might think there were way more people involved in this than went down for it, right?
Yeah.
But you got to think, this was like a third of the population of the school. And he was just getting things moved away from the old ways, the old debaucherous ways of West Point. That sounds funny. Getting things on track for his government. He'd been given some attaboys. And he didn't want to lose everybody. He just wanted, like, the main aggressors to take the fall and have it be a teachable moment, which I can appreciate.
Yeah. Tough but fair. And so the riot included, as Noel, I believe you pointed out earlier, nearly one-third of West Point students, and it changed the approach in the face of the academy for decades to come. But West Point's command historian, Sherman Fleek.
That name is on fleek.
It is. It is literally on fleek. Famously was incorrect when he said,
"Hardly anyone knows about it. If pooled among 4,400 cadets, I don't know why I think he talks like this, 3,000 federal employees, 1,500 military staff and faculty, I doubt 30 people will know a thing about it." This guy's not even old-timey. He's in our current day and age. Doesn't matter. Why would I not do a voice?
Right, but way more than 30 people know about this, and, you know, more than 30 people should.
Yeah, I don't know. I think nowadays eggnog is maybe remembered less as the source of drunken, riotous revelry at West Point and more of a non-alcoholic kind of holiday drink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, my kid likes eggnog. They have eggnog milkshakes at Sonic and, you know, eggnog frappuccinos.
Yeah, at Starbucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And eggnog's certainly not associated with crazy college parties gone wrong. That's more of a Jägerbomb thing.
That's true. My whole thing with eggnog is it's got so much sugar and milk and cream in it. Mm. It just seems like it would make you sick before you'd get drunk enough.
It feels like a Lebowski drink to me.
Just drink the whiskey, man.
Yeah.
Just drink the whiskey.
Is that our PSA? Is that our moral for this?
Sure.
For today's episode?
Why not?
Just drink the whiskey and the rum and the wine.
Whatever you got.
We are going to wrap it up. We would like to hear from you. Does this change the way you feel about West Point? I don't know why we're going with that question. We want to hear about your experience with eggnog. Do you have your own eggnog recipe? Because a lot of people do. You know, our composer Alex Williams, as you said, modeled his after George Washington, but he had to figure out the amount of eggs himself.
Yeah, exactly. And why not make a batch of your own George Washington eggnog and send us a note and let us know how you liked it. It's ridiculous at howstuffworks.com. You can also write us on the Facebooks, where we are Ridiculous History. And we have a nifty new Facebook group called the Ridiculous Historians,
where you can find your fellow listeners hipping each other to ridiculous stories throughout the span of human civilization. You can also find us two jokers on there as well.
Yeah, we lurk.
Yeah, we lurk. We comment as well. And we do also look to this page for inspiration for future topics. So thanks to everyone who's already made so many excellent suggestions. You can also find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us wherever you get podcasts. Oh, gosh, that's right. We even have a website, Noel. Did you know that?
I did know that. Isn't it ridiculoushistoryshow.com?
Spot on, my friend. That's where you can find every episode that we have ever done. So check it out and let us know what you would like to hear next. We've been getting some fantastic emails, and it always makes our day to read them. And as always, we want to thank our super producer and eggnog enthusiast. Wait, let me check. Casey?
No.
Okay. Our super producer, Casey Pegram, who is not a fan of eggnog.
No, not a nog guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Casey would probably agree with me in saying, just drink the whiskey, man. Just drink the whiskey.
And we want to thank Lori L. Dove, our regular contributor, for her excellent article on How Stuff Works.
And I guess most importantly, other than thanking you, Ben.
Oh, thank you, Noel.
Let me do this every time.
I don't know. You know, let's not force it. Let's just let it happen.
Okay. I'm open to that. We'd like to thank you, folks, for listening to the show. And we hope you'll join us for our next episode where we talk about weird people who built weird stuff.
That is literally going to be the title.
Yep. See you then.